Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. To support great podcasts like this one, please donate by clicking the link in the show description. With me today is Brad Wilcox. He is a senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia, and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Talking today about work with the Institute for Family Studies. Mostly, you can find them at ifstudies.org. Brad, thanks so much for joining us.
Scott, it's great to be here today.
We tend to begin these in very much the same way. We asked Brad to tell us, what is the mission at the Institute for Family Studies? Why does the organization exist?
Thanks, Scott. Well, the basic mission of the Institute for Family Studies is to kind of understand what's happening to families, marriages, and child well-being, and to also determine how we can strengthen our families in the U.S. to make them stronger and more stable when it comes to any number of outcomes. By looking in part at research, by thinking about public policies that would be helpful for families, and by also advocating for kind of cultural strategies that insights and data points that we think can help ordinary Americans forge stronger families. So that's kind of like the quick answer to your question. But I think kind of in terms of stepping back here just for a quick second, you know, a lot of Americans really since the 1970s have kind of embraced kind of more me first mentality that sort of focuses on maybe for some, you know, education, for some work, for some just having fun, a good time in life. And we think have kind of, you know, basically lost one of the most fundamental truths of our nature. And that is that we are social animals. And we are much more likely to flourish when we are living in communities. Those could be, you know, religious communities. Those could be just local communities of one sort or another. But the most fundamental community from our perspective at IFS is the family. And so people who are kind of living in and for, you know, their kin, their spouse, their children, their parents, their in-laws, you know, we think are more likely to be flourishing, not necessarily in the moment at any one point in time. If you've got, you know, little kids and changing diapers and up late at night, or difficult teenage kids as well, you know, those are all tough things, as I'm sure everyone here knows. But in general, our point is that people derive more meaning, happiness, direction, and a sense of fundamentally solidarity when they're living in a family and doing so kind of in a virtuous way.
How do you draw, or what is the connection between strong families, strong marriages, and a thriving economy for our country? Where is that line drawn?
Well, I think it's important to understand and appreciate at one level that just sort of demographically, growth depends, you know, at least it has depended for a long time, on a growing population. And so kind of one point to make here, in a world where we're seeing fertility fall below the replacement level of 2.1 babies per woman on average in many countries, including now the United States, is that if people don't have enough kids to kind of sustain the population or to grow the population, you know, that's going to lead to any number of economic problems down the road. A second point, though, of course, is that when families do a good job of raising kids, those kids end up being productive adults, you know, folks who are, you know, not only consumers, of course, but also producers who are, you know, who are gifted employees, talented employees, productive employees, and, you know, who've acquired the virtues and the skills and the knowledge they need to flourish in the contemporary marketplace. So again, you know, the idea is that families play a pretty important role in kind of giving kids what we call, you know, human capital in the social scientific world that then makes them, you know, good employees and good sort of future members of the marketplace. So those are kind of two ways that we could talk about it. And in terms of just some outcomes that we've looked at IFS, what we see in our research is that states that have strong families, more two-parent families, more married families, have markedly lower levels of child poverty, markedly higher levels of what's called economic mobility. That's sort of like basically poor kids having a chance over the life course to kind of move into the upper class. So states like Utah, for instance, are much more likely to push their poor kids up into the upper class compared to states like, you know, North Carolina, for instance, that have many more single parent families. So that would be another outcome we could look at. And then we've also looked at growth. And we find that, you know, controlling for a bunch of different factors, states that have more, you know, married Adults, more married parents tend to be more likely to enjoy higher levels of economic growth compared to states that have fewer married adults, fewer married parents in the mix as well. So those are kind of three outcomes that kind of illustrate how strong families tend to translate into better economic outcomes, in this case, at the state level.
I want to ask this question now because we'll be talking a lot about families and marriages, strong marriages, throughout the course of the conversation. And I don't have to tell anyone, the legal definition of marriage has changed in this country in the past years. How has that influenced your research at IFS? Or should we read anything different into the conclusions that have been drawn now that the legal definition of marriage in the country has changed?
We have looked at this issue, but one of the interesting things, Scott, about this is that when we look at the sort of the share, the number of kids who are living now in same-sex married families, it's, I think if I'm remembering the statistic correctly, and my colleague Wendy Wang did this, I think it's less than 1% of kids are living in married families headed by same-sex parents. So I think when it comes to kind of how has this kind of concretely affected families with kids in the United States, I think it's kind of been surprisingly small. And so we haven't kind of like done a specific analysis to sort of break out the impact of, you know, same-sex families on, you know, say, for instance, economic outcomes. And that's in part just because when it comes at least to kids, we haven't seen, you know, same-sex families sort of move into a place where they're exercising a big influence on children's lives, you know, kind of from a numerical or from a demographic perspective in that way.
Talking with Brad Wilcox from the Institute for Family Studies, we have seen generally a retreat from marriage among working class Americans. And Charles Murray had a line about how many liberals in this country, and the working class and upper class, but too often are not preaching what they practice, meaning that they have found success through their strong marriages, but aren't talking enough and preaching enough about why that is important to younger generations. Is part of the solution here simply having the conversation, opening up and telling people why this is important?
Yeah, and I would go kind of beyond just that point about preaching what you practice. It's a much more kind of fundamental institutional problem we have. And that is that when you think about the elites who control the commanding heights of our culture, from the academy to the media to the pop culture, now to corporate America, what you often see, in fact, we did a study on California. We found that, you know, some of the neighborhoods in the heart of Hollywood had the highest rates we'd seen of two-parent families.
You know?
And so there's just huge tension between kind of what people are kind of talking about, but also using institutional influence to sort of educate the public about. And so I think, you know, what we need is more, you know, showrunners, more producers, more school superintendents, more C-suite executives, you know, more professional medical associations, more journalists. In other words, all the people who kind of have some impact on our common culture doing what they can to kind of communicate that, hey, you know, the best thing you can do for, you know, for yourself and your kids, you know, for most folks is to get and stay married. And unfortunately, that message has not been delivered in any kind of great way or in great volume, I would say, really since the 1970s.
And the role that fathers play in these strong marriages for children, what are those attributes? What do fathers do in the two-parent household that is missing when they're gone?
So, you know, one thing to note here, of course, is that some of the older notions actually are still actually quite relevant. So when it comes to money, for instance, in the average married family, even today, you know, the dad is the primary breadwinner. And of course, money matters for, you know, things like, you know, the quality of your housing, schooling, you know, unfortunately today, you know, travel, soccer and whatever else, you know, all these things, you know, are important to have, you know, dad's financial contributions going right into the family in that way. And secondly, too, on sort of the older ideal, you know, dad's discipline is distinctive. Dads are more authoritative. The sort of their physical presence, you know, affects kids in different ways than moms. You know, just kids kind of are more likely to take note of dads because they tend to be larger and stronger and have deeper voices. And there's real science based, you know, on all that stuff. But beyond that, we're also seeing in the research is that the physical play the kind of rough and tumble play that dads often engage with their children, particularly the younger kids, ends up looking like to be important as well. So there's just something about kind of having, wrestling with your kids on the center room floor, or, going outside and throwing a football or baseball or kicking a soccer ball, or playing tag, or whatever else in the pool you might do with your kids. That's something about that physical interaction with your children, both your sons and daughters, that engenders a sense of well-being in your kids. And even it's been linked to being more socially adept in elementary school classrooms. So I think there is something quite basic in that physical relationship between fathers and kids that we, I don't think, always appreciate, but that's there. And we should encourage our dads, to be more kind of deliberate or active, in terms of engaging their kids physically as playmates. Another thing that we see too is that dads tend to kind of challenge their kids to embrace life's opportunities and to endure life's hardships more than moms. One example of this comes from a study in France where they were looking at moms and dads sort of helping their toddlers learn to swim. And what moms did was they would hold the toddlers eye to eye in the pool and kind of work with them in that way. Mm-hmm. Whereas dads are much more likely to take the toddler and turn him around to sort of face out into the deep of the water and kind of encourage the toddler to learn to swim that way. It's a nice example of the way in which dads, I think, play an important role in encouraging their kids, both at a young age like that and older ages, to kind of, leave the nest, both literally and metaphorically.
There's a tab at the website for the Institute for Family Studies at ifstudies.org that says Success Sequence. And this is something that the Institute has talked about for a while. And there's, I believe, a book being worked on the success sequence as well. What is the success sequence? How can people follow it? What are the likely results if you do?
Yeah, the sequence is pretty straightforward. It's three steps. Get at least a high school degree for kind of offering these steps for young adults. Although we'd sort of say either a college degree or a technical degree is certainly, we think, helpful here. But get at least a high school degree is the first step. The second step is, seek full-time employment in your early 20s. The third step is to marry before having any children. So the idea is if you take those three steps, education, work, and marriage, before having kids, your odds of kind of realizing the American dream financially are quite high. 86% of folks who are, following those three steps will be in the middle class or higher, in their late 20s and 30s. And then we also find that only 3% of folks who follow those three steps are ending up in poverty by their late 20s or their 30s. So there's just a very strong association between, getting at least a modicum of education, working full time, and marrying for having kids that we think a lot of young adults don't necessarily always appreciate today.
Let me ask this. There is some critiques of the success sequence. One is that this is just a path that people who are already likely to succeed, who perhaps have fewer barriers to success in their life, are already going to walk. That it's not a formula for success as much as it is a remnant of things that were already apparent and obvious in these people's lives. So would these outcomes happen even if the success sequence weren't followed? That's the question.
Well, yeah, there's just no doubt that people who are kind of motivated, hardworking, disciplined, are more likely to walk the pathway of the success sequence and, to realize it. It's also the case, as we've, talked about in our reports, that people who are kind of hailing from more privileged backgrounds are more likely to walk the sequence too. So there is a kind of like a structural or institutional or sociological story to kind of, tell about all of this. But we also kind of underline in our newest report on the success sequence, which was on that webpage you mentioned, that more than 95% of Black and Hispanic and White and Asian American young adults who follow the sequence will avoid poverty, and that's also true for more than 95% of young adults who are coming from lower income backgrounds. So the point here is that it doesn't really matter where you're coming from if you can kind of manage to do those three simple things, you're going to be much more likely to flourish. And it's important to note that. We actually have seen in the U.S. an increase in high school graduation in recent decades. So on that score, that's good from the success sequence vantage point. But we've seen a declining number of young adults, particularly young men, working full-time. And, of course, obviously a declining number of young men and young women who are getting married before having children. Or to flip it, we're seeing more kids being born outside of wedlock. And so on those two points, kind of in taking this sort of evidence to encourage young men to be more deliberate about working full time. You know, I think that's one of the takeaways here, if they're not, you know, in schooling or in college of some sort. And then encouraging couples to put, you know, a ring on it before they have children is another kind of very clear takeaway. And if they do those, you know, two things, work full time and have a wedding, I mean, and a marriage, before they have children, they're much more likely to be flourishing, not just economically, but also, of course, socially as well.
You were lamenting earlier, and you're not alone, of course, the decline in birth rates in America. The success sequence says you should do A, you should do B before you have children. Is there any thought that perhaps by pushing it off till a little bit later in life or a little bit later than you might have if not following the success sequence, that is also perhaps in a way pushing down the birth rate as well? Do we just need to see more people having more children overall?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Scott. I mean, I think there is sort of a quantity quality issue that sort of or trade-off that's sort of embedded in your question to some extent. But when we talk about the success sequence, we're not saying you have to get a PhD or a master's. You know, we're not saying that you have to, you know, be making $100,000, you know, at your workplace before you go ahead and get married and have children. So there's no reason, you know, the success sequence, you know, wouldn't allow for a couple who are, you know, meeting in the early 20s, you know, to marry at that point and have kids. And if we were to see kind of more folks getting married in their 20s, a lot of our birth rate troubles would go away. And also, of course, our troubles with sort of family instability as well, because what we're seeing right now is that when people are having kids in their teens and 20s, you know, they're doing it oftentimes outside of marriage. Most, you know, kids born in the 30s, you know, are being born to married couples. So I think kind of thinking about the 20s, particularly as a kind of an arena where we could encourage couples to be more deliberate about thinking about marriage, you know, before having kids. And that would also, you know, I think end up boosting our birth rate as well.
This is called the success sequence. Is there a need to convince more Americans that success equals a happy, stable family life, that success equals children, loving children? And how do you do that? I think when people picture children, those who are uninclined to perhaps or disinclined to have children, they think about sort of the thing you had mentioned earlier in the conversation, which is crying kids at midnight and dirty diapers all day long, and you give up a portion of yourself and your life to this child, which in fact has rewards. But how do you talk to them about this success sequence and show them that this is what success looks like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think if you kind of move to a different topic, I mean, just quickly, and think about, you know, the sports world, or if you think about, you know, the educational professional world, you know, well, I think there's a recognition that to excel when it comes to athletics, to excel when it comes to, you know, the professional work in a job, when it comes to excelling in school, most people understand and appreciate that there are plenty of sacrifices that go into athletic or educational or professional success. And yet, if you kind of make the sacrifices and do those things well, you know, athletically, educationally, or professionally, you tend to enjoy a measure of satisfaction, you know, from a job well done. Not, you're not always happy, but you're satisfied. Like, you've actually done something meaningful. You become a great soccer player or a great, you know, a mathematician or a great, you know, lawyer, you know, whatever it might be, right? But I think we have to have the same mentality when it comes to the family, that it is the case that being a good husband, being a good wife, being a good father, being a good mother, these things require a lot of hard work, a lot of suffering, a lot of sacrifice. But if you do them and you invest in those roles, you know, you're much more likely to be flourishing, you know, both emotionally and otherwise, socially and financially, than your fellow Americans who are not doing those things. And there's just a ton of evidence indicating that married Americans, and now even today, married Americans with kids, are more likely to be reporting that they're happy, but also, of course, even more likely to report that their lives are not meaningless or that they're not lonely compared to their fellow Americans who are, you know, single and childless. I think it's also important, too, to understand, appreciate in this debate or discussion, that a lot of the folks, I think, are discounting marriage and kids have rich and even very remunerative professional careers that give their lives meaning, direction, and purpose in the workforce. But when you kind of look back at sort of the bigger picture here, there's just no question that kind of the ordinary man and the ordinary woman in the United States who doesn't have kids and isn't married is much less likely to report that they're happy and more likely to report that they're lonely and their lives are not as meaningful. So we have to just remember too that, you know, most Americans, you know, don't write for the New York Times, don't have a high-powered career in a big law firm, are not college professors. And for, you know, ordinary Americans, then, you know, in the main, you know, a marriage and a family end up being a lot more important for their sense of meaning, direction, purpose, and happiness than work or other kinds of things.
Talking with Brad Wilcox, he is with the Institute for Family Studies as a senior fellow, more at ifstudies.org. He is on Twitter as well, at Brad Wilcox. At Brad Wilcox, IFS. You were just talking about this lack of satisfaction or loneliness for some. And there is a study from a couple of years ago, I believe, from IFS that looked at the difference between happiness among liberals and happiness among conservatives. And if I read the results correctly, only 15% of liberal women consider themselves very happy, and it was only 10% of high-income women who would earn $100,000 or more consider themselves to be very happy. Are they out there searching for that thing that will change their happiness?
You know, Scott, I think it is interesting. There is a kind of there's an ideological, a partisan story here. And Zach Goldberg has done a lot of work on the very issue you've been talking about. That is sort of actually how white liberal women tend to be less happy and more distressed than other Americans. But the work we've done is focusing sort of on the basic difference between conservative and liberals, Republicans, Democrats. And we do find that, you know, Republicans and conservatives are more likely to be happy than their fellow Democratic and liberal citizens. These aren't huge differences. If you were to kind of meet your average liberal neighbor and your average conservative neighbor, you know, there may be, you know, no difference. But just kind of like in the population as a whole, conservatives and Republicans have a slight advantage when it comes to happiness. And there are lots of theories about why this is the case. You know, one theory, of course, was that Republicans are just sort of more happy, you know, sort of living in a world that's fundamentally unequal. They just don't care about, you know, people's sufferings or the poor or whatever else. But when we looked at the sort of data, we find is that, in fact, it's not that explains the difference. It's really Republicans tend to be more married, more religious, and on some indicators, more involved in their communities. And those three things were kind of the factors that helped to explain the Republican or the conservative advantage. And again, this brings us back to the point I made at the beginning, that is that we're social animals. Mm-hmm. You know, women and men are. And so if we kind of live in accord with that that social dimension of our lives in families, in faith communities, or other communities around us, and really invest in those, you know, those institutions, we're more likely to flourish on average.
Another study that you worked on for the Institute for Family Studies is on strong families and better student performance, and looking to see if that is still true. Is the benefit of having two parents more valuable now, perhaps, than it even was a decade or two ago?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was at a sort of faculty conference in Maine about 2 weeks ago, and one of the women there was sort of talking about family structure and child well-being. And she was saying, well, isn't it true that, you know, kids are less affected today by things like divorce because, you know, it's just less stigmatized. You know, it's less of an issue in our culture today.
Right.
And I said, you know, that sounds like a perfectly plausible theory or hypothesis, but in fact, it's actually false. So we just did a report, as you were mentioning, that shows that the link between family structure and student behavior and performance in the last 25 years has gotten stronger, not weaker. So what that means concretely is that when you look at something like, for instance, being expelled or suspended from school, we're seeing the kind of empirical connection between being raised in a non-intact family, like divorce or, you know, stepfamily or single parent or whatever, is stronger in a more recent cohort a few years ago than it was, you know, about 25 years ago. The same idea is true for, you know, having parents contacted, you know, by the school for some kind of behavioral issue. And a similar pattern, although it wasn't statistically significant, when it comes to patterns of being held back a year in school or having issues with academic performance in school as well. But in every outcome we looked at, the association between sort of family structure and student outcomes was stronger in the more recent data set than it was in the data set that was collected about 25 years ago. So again, the point here is that the research is suggesting that if anything, the impact of growing up in an intact married family matters more today than it did, you know, 25 years ago. And that's surprising because, again, it's more accepted to be raised in an intact family. And I think that one part of that potential story is that dads are much more involved today with their kids than they were 25 or 40 years ago. And so I think in some ways, kids benefit even more today from an intact married family because they have a lot more attention, not just from mom, but also from their father, which, you know, I think on average gives them a leg up.
When it comes to the family unit and this, the research showing that it's actually more of a benefit to have loving parents, two loving parents now than it was years ago, I think about the freedom that we have now to be more mobile across the country, where perhaps a larger family unit would stick together in the same metropolitan area 30 years ago, 20 years ago. Those family members can be scattered across the country and still communicate very easily via cell phones, via Zoom, via Skype. And that seems to be more of an accepted way of life, that you have families kind of scattered. Is that perhaps one of the reasons why having that intimate family structure of parents and children in a household is even more important now than it was previously, because that greater family unit, the extended family, might not be close?
There's a kind of a long, actually a really long running kind of debate about kind of the nuclear of the extended family kind of in the American experience. And obviously technology has kind of changed this whole calculus and our thinking about it in more recent years. I guess I think it is the case that having, you know, two married parents on scene is especially important in, you know, situations where you're living far from, you know, from kin. So I think that's certainly the case. But I also would say that, you know, if you have the choice, I would definitely encourage folks to try to live closer to kin. Because I think it's great for intergenerational ties to be forged between grandparents and grandchildren, and between cousins, uncles and aunts, and, you know, nieces and nephews. And then also just as a practical matter too, I mean, if you're having, you know, more than one child, you know, two, three, four, whatever it might be, children, it's, you know, I think often a lot easier to kind of raise your kids, you know, in proximity to kin, especially grandparents or uncles and aunts. So I think, you know, I would definitely encourage folks who have any kind of flexibility in this regard to, you know, do what they can either to live close to their kin, or in some cases, as with us, have, you know, kin come close to that, you know, as well. So I think that often can make the burdens of parenting more manageable.
Over at the website ifstudies.org, it says the fact that roughly one in two children in America grow up outside of an intact married family constitutes one of the most significant threats to America's future stability and prosperity. Well, here we are in the future of freedom. We can talk about that future, that possible future. The work of the Institute, is it focused on changing minds and changing behavior, or is that need to be supported with policy changes at the governmental level, whether that's at the federal or state level? Where's the focus for the Institute?
Yeah, I'd say it's a pretty dual focus. We focused a lot more on cultural change, you know, for much of the last 10 years, and we're basically up on our 10th anniversary coming up. But I think we do recognize that there is a place for both state policies and for federal policies. And on the state level, for instance, we think having some kind of success sequence requirement added to like a family life curriculum expectation for states would be helpful. At the federal level, we think addressing the marriage penalty that's embedded in many of our means tested programs would be a kind of a step in the right direction. We're also in favor of the new, you know, kind of proposal that's been put forward by folks like Orrin Cass at American Compass and Senator Mitt Romney, that would kind of advance a child tax credit that would go to families where there's at least some work happening and give working class and middle class families, you know, more resources to devote to their kids and also to kind of choose how best to care for their kids, you know. And it's sort of like I know there's been support on the right for kind of school choice, you know, for parents of school-age children. We're kind of taking that same idea, the same mentality, and sort of saying we should also be giving money to parents with younger kids so they can kind of make choices about how best to care for them and rear those kids. And if need be, have, you know, a parent stay at home to invest more in, you know, the care and rearing of the rising generation.
Looking forward, you mentioned that the Institute's around 10 years old, and maybe there's a little shift, or there's some things that can change now after 10 years of work on the ground. How do you see, or where do you see the Institute perhaps changing, or where does that focus lie here in the next 5-10 years for the Institute for Family Studies?
So we've had, I think, a lot of success in reaching the mainstream and conservative media. You know, in the last 2 weeks, we've been in outlets as divergent as The Atlantic and Fox News. And we want to continue to build on that sort of success in reaching those media outlets. But I think we want to also be doing more to reach civic outlets, you know, religious institutions, youth groups, colleges, high schools that are, you know, kind of open to our family-friendly message. I've seen at UVA, for instance, you know, a growing number of students who are just desperate for guidance when it comes to things like dating and marriage and family life. And they've kind of, you know, they've looked around, or they've seen in their own families things just kind of falling apart. And they know that there must be a better way out there. And so I think IFS would like to do a better job of kind of reaching young adult audiences who are looking for, you know, greater direction and greater clarity about how best to forge a strong, stable family. And then the other thing that we touched on earlier is just we are doing more on the policy front. Governor's office reached out to me just 2 days ago looking for, you know, 20 policy ideas for, this state that would be helpful in terms of strengthening families in this state in the U.S. So I think doing more to kind of give constructive advice to policymakers, both on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and then in the states across the U.S. as well.
Brad Wilcox is Senior Fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, ifstudies.org. You can find him on Twitter at Brad Wilcox, IFS. Brad, thanks so much for joining us here on The Future of Freedom.
Scott, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
I'm Scott Bertram. For more episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine podcasts from America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.